This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Phoebe Judge. 9 months before he delivered his acclaimed I Have a Dream speech from the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered a version of that speech to a crowd packed into a gym at Booker T. Washington High School in Rocky Mount, North Carolina.
My friends of Rocky Mount, I have a dream tonight. It is a dream rooted deeply in the American dream. I have a dream that one day, down in Sasser County, Georgia, where they burned two churches down a few days ago because Negroes wanted to register and vote, one day right down there, little black boys and little black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and little white girls and walk the streets as brothers and sisters. I have a dream that one day, right here in Rocky Mountain, North Carolina, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will meet at the table of brotherhood, knowing that out of one blood God made all men to dwell upon the face of earth.
The Rocky Mount speech is the first known time King used the refrain, I have a dream. The speech also included other famous passages such as How Long, Not Long, and Let Freedom Ring. The Rocky Mount speech was recorded on a reel-to-reel tape that has since been carefully restored. NC State professor Jason Miller led the effort to preserve the speech, and this weekend he is leading an effort to help the public gain new understanding of Martin Luther King Jr. with a celebration at NC State called Experiencing King. He's with me in the studio today. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you.
David Garrow also joins me in the studio. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer of Martin Luther King Jr. Welcome, David.
Thank you.
Jason, let's start with you. I know you've told this story before on our air, but remind us how you came to discover the Rocky Mount speech.
So about 8 years ago, I was beginning a research project starting to track the use by Dr. King of Langston Hughes's poetry in his speeches and sermons. Langston Hughes, a leading figure of the Harlem Renaissance. And when I started tracing Dr. King's use of seven different Hughes poems, including Dream Deferred and I Dream a World, I started tracking and mapping every single instance and reference by Dr. King. And this led me to the city of Rocky Mount, where I found not only a transcript, but then heard rumor and was able to find the actual audio tape on a 7-inch reel-to-reel tape of 1.5 millimeter acetate. I was thrilled and excited, and so good friend of this show, Skip Alzheimer, made sure that I knew where to go, and he suggested George Blood, the leading audio archivist in the nation who actually wrote the book for the Library of Congress. I called up George, and I said, George, we need you to kind of digitize this tape for us. He said, just go ahead and put it in the mail. And I said, well, this is the first time we know Dr. King ever said, I had a dream. He said, can you come Sunday? So that began the process for us.
So the speech had been there, this recording, in Rocky Mount. Where did you actually find it?
So people that I've been able to coordinate with have said it's a miracle it survived because the city itself has undergone so much hurricane, tropical storm damage. Important documents in the city are missing. But a wonderful woman had kept this in her attic for 38 years and kind of served as kind of the de facto librarian of the city. And then it circulated after that at a time when the technology couldn't do anything with it. And so finally, it certainly was more than serendipity. It was providence. I think, at the same time that this recording surfaced, I was searching for it ardently. And so that made it available, and now has been something we've been able to share and deepen the historical record of not only Dr. King, but also of Langston Hughes.
You just found it in a box.
Yes, and the box is absolutely unremarkable. And David's been through materials like this where your arms just turn chilled. The box on the inside says, Dr. Martin Luther King's speech, November 27, 1962. Please do not erase. Fortunately, no one did.
David, what was your reaction the first time you heard that Rocky Mount speech? I mean, this must be incredibly exciting for a historian like you.
It's wonderful to hear, and it's a great example of how Dr. King virtually never spoke from a text or from notes. He had all of this material in his head, and I'm not an English professor like Jason. I'm just a historian, so I can't do the textual piece of this so well or the rhetorical piece of it. But Doc, that's how I refer to him, Doc had this mental library of all sorts, biblical quotations, poetic sources, and he would use and incorporate and recombine all of this material off the cuff, off the top of his head in all sorts of different settings. It's important for people to realize that being Martin Luther King in 1962 meant you were speaking at least once a day. Reel-to-reel tapes were the technology of the time, and depending upon the church or the civic group that was hosting him, it might get recorded.
So will you put this speech in historical context for us?
It's not at all surprising that Dr. King at the March on Washington, August 28th, 63, essentially, you know, 9 months almost to the day after this, would revisit it. Especially in Dr. King's church sermons, you'll see him use and reuse the same material in slightly different ways time and again. Keith Miller's wonderful book, Voice of Deliverance, 1991, the best study of King's preaching. Keith's book is superb about the sort of the oral tradition of the black church of which Dr. King was an exemplar.
Jason, how will the public be able to experience the speech this weekend?
So this weekend, we're kicking off with our highlight event this evening with Danny Glover and Felix Justice performing An Evening with Martin and Langston. And Danny Glover portrays Langston Hughes and Felix Justice portrays Dr. King. Unfortunately, tickets for that event are sold out. But tomorrow, free and open to the public, we have two showcase events. Cynthia St. James will be unveiling original artwork so people can see things that are actually going to be used for a movie, Origins of the Dream. It's about this project. And our capstone event is David Garrow's conversation at 2:30 tomorrow, and he will tell us all his vast information about what he's learned from being the really unsurpassed expert on Dr. King. But you can also tour the library. And so we have actually a world-class library at NC State. It's actually a National Medal Award-winning library. And so the technologies and expertise there, you'll be able to hear one of Dr. King's speeches under the VMLK project that he delivered right here in Durham. And you'll be able to walk in and kind of see the photographs and hear that recreated. And then you can hear this speech, interact with it, and see the film that's underway as well.
Well, let's talk about that. You mentioned Langston Hughes. You're also working on a documentary film that looks into the connections between the poet Langston Hughes and Martin Luther King. How does the Rocky Mount speech link to the poetry of Langston Hughes?
So, as David was saying so astutely, Dr. King used these materials all over the place in any number of moments. The speech in Rocky Mount actually dates back to at least August 11th, 1956, Facing the Challenge of a New Age, is a speech Dr. King gave in Buffalo. And scholars have long said that the end of that speech is really the beginnings of the Great Dream Sequence. Well, what I've been able to do is actually take that sequence from that speech and write it out as poetry and compare it to Langston Hughes' poem, I Dream a World, and you can see that what Dr. King is doing is he's riffing, alluding, signifying, or sampling line for line at that time. And so this is the latest revision of his interaction with that poem and his own creation.
We don't have a recording of I Dream a World read by Langston Hughes, but in your film, it's read by former Congressman and UN Ambassador Andrew Young, who is a friend of Martin Luther King Jr. Let's listen.
I dream a world where man no other man will scorn, where love will bless the earth and peace its paths adorn. I dream a world where all will know sweet freedom's way, where greed no longer saps the soul, nor avarice blights our day. A world I dream where black or white, whatever race may be, will share the bounties of the earth and every man is free. Where wretchedness will hang its head and joy like a pearl attends the needs of all mankind. Of such I dream our world.
That was former Congressman and UN Ambassador Andrew Young reading the Langston Hughes poem, I Dream a World. It's included in the documentary, Origin of the Dream. And Jason, it's very fascinating. I mean, the play off of each other is just kind of remarkable.
It is, and there's so many connections because Dr. King knew this poetry by memory, as David mentioned. So the first Mother's Day that Coretta experiences, Dr. King quotes Langston Hughes' poem, Mother to Son, from memory, as kind of to honor her. And there's actually all these other engagements. In fact, Dr. King even wrote a letter asking Langston Jackson Hughes to write a private poem, and we've been able to uncover that unpublished poem. And so there are so many ways that Dr. King was so enamored with poetry and having this reservoir in his bank to pull from. And when kids in my class, I ask them, "I have a dream," and they go to, "I dream a world," they can hear the cadence, they make the connection, and they understand Dr. King's great immeasurable power to take something from the past and renew it. And he has this wonderful definition where he said, doing something creative is not making something new, it's bringing an old form to a new medium. And that's what he did so well.
David, you know, if Langston Hughes was such an influence on Dr. King's life, explain to us why he never overtly referenced Langston Hughes's name after about 1960.
As Jason so nicely said, Dr. King had this ability to learn and absorb and retain this huge mental library of quotations, stories, song lyrics, poems. And early on, 1956, 1957, when Dr. King is first being recorded a lot for the first time, in those earlier years, he'll do a little bit more direct citation when he's mentioning something, using something. But as the years go by and the materials become more and more familiar to him, as the sort of Brunswick stew of it becomes, you know, more processed, the direct citations drop out. It becomes more naturally his own as the years go by. And so that's why the explicit references tend to drift away.
And is there anything else? I mean, Langston Hughes also became a rather controversial figure in his own right for his political views. What about those ties to King?
That wouldn't have been something that worried Dr. King at all. I mean, King was very almost obstinate in not being politically correct about distancing himself from someone who might be the subject of criticism or controversy.
And Langston Hughes was labeled a communist widely.
Dr. King was so dismissive of fear of communists, having been labeled one himself as early as 1957, Doc was very dismissive of this notion that communism was an infectious disease.
So he just said, "I won't even give any time to that."
Yeah, you know, even when the Kennedy brothers in 1963 are insisting to him that one of his closest friends is a dangerous Soviet agent. Even with President Kennedy, Dr. King's attitude is essentially, "Sorry, Charlie."
Well, let's talk a little bit about the FBI and King. After the famous "I Have a Dream" speech made on the National Mall, an FBI memo called King the most dangerous and effective Negro leader in the country. Was it dangerous in some ways for Martin Luther King to be expressing those ideas as freely as he was?
The FBI had a fundamentally paternalistic view towards black America, and they viewed Dr. King as dangerous because he was not a political friend of theirs, as were some other black leaders of the time. Roy Wilkins of the NAACP, Thurgood Marshall of the NAACP, James Farmer of CORE, Whitney Young. They had good relations with the FBI, but the FBI, with some accuracy, thought that Dr. King was a politically independent voice.
We've heard about the FBI secret wiretaps of King. You've heard those tapes. What do they illuminate for us beyond, let's say, King's love life?
The best part of all the FBI wiretapping of Dr. King and his closest advisors is it very powerfully illuminates how intensely self-critical Dr. King was. When he's named Time Magazine's Man of the Year, he's not someone who glories in his press clips, glories in these awards and prizes. He instead is telling his friends that he feels he's getting too much credit, individual. He feels guilty that he's attracting all of this attention and fame. So to me, the great, wonderful irony of all the FBI recordings is that they depict just how fundamentally humble, full of humility, the real Martin Luther King Jr. was.
Do we hear in those tapes any time where he's questioning his own speeches or what he will say, or did that go over well?
No. King as a speaker was unsurprisingly self-confident. The only time you'll hear an uncertain Dr. King is on a very few occasions when he is reading a speech text to some like white professional group where the text has been written by one of his advisors. And if you hear a recording of that, you would not think it's Martin Luther King because it doesn't sound like the Dr. King that we heard in Rocky Mount.
This week we've been hearing a lot about the brand new Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture. Of course, you would imagine that Dr. King would be a major player at that museum. Do you have any opinions or thoughts about why Dr. King is not well represented there?
The King family for 20 years now, in a variety of contexts with a variety of broadcasts and repositories, has wanted to maximize its own income from Dr. King's legacy and not maximize the broadcast or display of Dr. King's legacy. So given how the surviving King children always have their hand out and are interested in their own financial betterment, that again, unfortunately, explains why this wonderful new museum has not been able to receive anything from the King family to put on display.
Funny also because it's so close to where Dr. King gave that famous speech.
Exactly.
Jason, you now have a chance to really study in depth the lyrical nature of King's speeches, looking at all the poetry that he drew from. How has this gained your appreciation for Dr. King, really studying these words that he wrote?
Well, we know so much already because of the great work of scholars of what Dr. King's contribution is to history, what his philosophical resources have been and his quotations. We know what he's meant for the culture, and we get to visit with people all the time, including people with Rocky Mount, and say just one visit with Dr. King, what they did for him. But this research has drawn our attention to Dr. King's affinity for poetry. So it's interesting when we hear these quotes from Isaiah 40 or from Amos 5, we think, well, that's biblical prophecy. But prophecy is always a co-requisite for poetry. And so Langston Hughes, James Russell Lowell, William Cullen Bryant, these psalmists, Dr. King loved poetry. And if you actually look at his collection of his note cards that is housed down in the Atlanta area, when he drew quotes from the Bible, they were almost primarily from the Psalms and the Proverbs, not from the letters of Paul. And so he loved this aspect of oral performance in poetry. And you can tell from the letters that Stanley Levinson writes to him, when Langston Hughes agrees to write that poem for this occasion, he's more excited about that than hearing that Eleanor Roosevelt's going to attend. And so for Dr. King to be able to engage in poetry reminds us that it isn't just his engagement with the Bible. It's also his engagement with the American dream, and it's also his engagement with poetry. And poetry is where memory breathes. So when we remember that speech as "I have a dream," it's not just because he said it 8 times or 10 times. It's because it has that element of oral poetry.
My guests are Jason Miller and David Garrow. Jason Miller is an English professor at North Carolina State University and a producer and writer for The Origin of the Dream documentary film. David Garrow is a historian and a Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer of Martin Luther King Jr. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
They are participants in a series of public events this weekend at NC State University called Experiencing King. Just ahead, the music of Liz Weiss.